Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is the Distraction Pieces podcast, episode 442. Thank you for tuning in, guys. I'm joined today by the amazing Craig Roberts. It's been another one where it's a conversation we've been lining up for a while, but it's come at the perfect time. So I can't wait for you to hear it. Craig is an amazing actor, writer, director. He does it all. And it's just, as someone who's got plenty of acting under my belt now, got to work on some amazing projects. Speaking of which, Taboo is now on Netflix in the UK. But I've had loads of scripts in development and I've got a few bits I want to direct. So I really wanted to pick Craig's brain about how he's got to where he is. And spoiler alert, it's through incredible talent. So yeah, I think you're going to enjoy this. If this is your first time tuning in, head back through the back catalogue. I've had so many amazing writers, directors and actors. I mean, let's just go on the actors front. We've had Florence Pugh, Stephen Graham, Michael Fassbender, Simon Pegg, Lena Headey, Niamh Algar, James McAvoy. Just a long, long list of amazing people. So check out the back catalogue. And also, in this conversation, we weirdly end up talking briefly about Twitch. I've now launched on Twitch. So head to twitch.tv/ScroobiusPip. I'm playing a game called Rust on a server run by Scottish comedian and streamer Limmy, previous guest as well. So come and hang out there. If you're thinking, what the hell is that? Just head to twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipYo or just download the Twitch app and come find me. Start watching and it will start to make sense. Learn by doing. This isn't an advert. We're brought to you as ever by speechofelementrecords.com. We've topped up on a load of the XL, double XL and triple XL tees and jackets and stuff like that. So head over there if you want any of that goodness. And as ever, patreon.com/ScroobiusPip if you want to chip in a little bit towards the upkeep of the podcast. That's all I've got to tell you about. This is episode 442 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the amazing Craig Roberts. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. This piece of fiction is the intro to Distraction Pieces. Be lucky if we don't get the wind. My God, it's literally blowing everything on the drive right now.
Yeah, we chose the windiest of days to be recording, so hopefully our words don't get blown away too much. But I'm joined today by Craig Roberts. How are you, sir?
I'm well, thank you. Thanks for having me. How are you?
I'm good, and I need to say up front, I feel at a weird advantage here because I've been speaking to different PR people and stuff, I think a lot, Rom, for a good few years now about having you on. So I feel I've known this conversation is going to happen for years, and you've probably got an email earlier in the week saying, oh, you're doing a podcast on Friday. So, yeah, apologies for my advantage in preparation for our conversation.
Not at all. I know about your podcast. I love the podcast, and I've known about you wanting to do something. So, yeah, for sure. Let's talk.
I love it. Well, I mean, I'm a fan of your work, but I've been excited to talk because I'm fascinated by you, because as myself, an actor and a writer and aspiring director, the fact that you've done all of this and done three films now at the age of 31, and you're not a kind of legacy kid with, you know, all of your parents. Like, I'm similar. I'm from a small town in Essex. You're from a small town in Wales. I've not had a family of who are all in the industry and stuff like that. So I want to get into your whole journey, really. So, I mean, let's go all the way back. You grew up in a small town in Wales, right? Where was that?
Maisecomer. By the way, thank you for the nice words. I appreciate that. Maisecomer. None of my family are in the industry in any way. My dad worked on the council, and my mum is a domiciliary nurse, works at a home that looks after people that live with dementia and Alzheimer's. And my sister is in the same kind of sector, I suppose, but like in a managerial role. So yeah, nobody in the industry, although my grandfather was a ventriloquist act and a mime.
Amazing.
Back in the '60s, which is pretty cool. And I still have his puppet, which is awesome.
Oh, wow.
So that's probably the connection I have to some kind of entertainment in some way, I suppose. And I didn't really realize that until a couple of years ago. I'd kind of forgotten because he passed away very early in my life.
Yeah.
But I do remember him kind of, I suppose, you know, singing certain songs and me getting up and stuff with him doing stuff. So that's probably where it started. But I didn't really want to, I can't sit here and be like, I want to be an actor, because I didn't really know it was a thing, really. You know,
yeah.
It's not, it was all about football or rugby when I was in school.
Yeah.
And my parents, I did spend a lot of time in my house playing Xbox, and I think they just wanted me to get out a bit more. So they put me in a stagecoach. But the stagecoach was too expensive. It was really expensive. Yeah. So we pulled out of that after, I think, I don't know, maybe a year. And I went back to thinking I could be a football player. And then my dad found out about like an improv class that was being ran in Cardiff, called Atsley's Castings. And yeah, I went there, I think at about the age of 12, it was just like an hour in the evening. It was like a social club, really. And that's kind of where it started, because one of the first auditions I had was a show called Tracy Beaker. Mm-hmm. And I went through the rounds of doing that. I went through so many rounds because I was too Welsh in a way. My accent was so Welsh that they had to like see if they could bring it back
yeah.
a little bit.
We wanted someone Welsh, but not this Welsh. Let's be reasonable here. Come on.
But it's probably why I don't sound as Welsh as I probably should.
Yeah.
It probably started with that, really. So then, yeah, then I did Tracy Beaker, and I did a bunch of kids' TV shows. I did another one after that called Young Dracula, and they were great. It was a great experience. It was awesome. I mean, you know, I got to hang out with cool people and, you know, spend my summers making stuff and having enough money afterwards to buy more Xbox games.
Yeah.
So that's like how it started, really. And
I love the idea that it started with your parents wanting to get you off your computer, and it backfired massively. You're like, nah, I was off my computer for a few weeks, and now I've got more computer games. So
yeah.
Joke's on you. I spoke to Beth Granville about this recently. And again, I relate massively because, again, the small town I live in, Essex, is near to London. And I think there's something really powerful in living in a small town or village that's going to have character and, most importantly, going to have boredom. So you kind of have to use your imagination and these things. But you're near to somewhere like Cardiff that can kind of give you a glimpse of that. There's so many things going on. There is the arts. There are all these different things happening. My brother lived in Lampeter for a long time, and whenever I'd go and stay at his, it would be you spend most of your time immersed in your own brain and mind, but then every now and then you pop into town and enjoy the riches of a city as such. So yeah, do you think that
exactly.
balance was good for you to go, right, I'm here again, particularly as a writer and director, I'm here around characters you couldn't make up? And again, I think small towns are full of that, of characters mm-hmm. that you couldn't even dream. If you wrote them fictionally, as you say, you'd be told that's too Welsh, or that's too unrealistic. But then, yeah, I guess having access to industries, and at the point you were growing up, I'd imagine a lot of things were moving to Cardiff and Swansea, and there were production companies and studios being built because it was all of a sudden this great place that, yeah, kind of all the advantages we've spoke of there. You've got a city, but you can drive for an hour and be shooting in a castle or on a wonderful coast and things like that. So it suddenly became this great place for TV and film.
Yeah, and not so much. I mean, now it's like crazy how much work is in Wales, but it was definitely picking up for sure.
Yeah.
I think what was, I suppose in a way it was kind of escapism going to Cardiff and places like that, certainly when I was younger, because I guess when I started working, I was surrounded by older people. So it made me, you know, and people that I suppose in some way wiser about what the world was. So like, I guess I grew up, I was forced to grow up quicker, you know, and that really helped. And, you know, it's always the thing of like, yeah, you need to get out of your town and really do something. And then when you get old enough, you're just like, I want to go back.
Yeah. Yeah. It's
like, I live in London now, and I really like it, but you know, there's just something about, I think being able to shut off when you go back to your hometown and, mm-hmm. and weirdly, I suppose it's kind of turned back on itself, where I wanted the escapism of getting out and doing more, but now it's like that's the escapism going back with his, you know, with his not as much, and my family are there and stuff, which is great.
Where have you been during the pandemic as such? Did you remain in London, or did you, and I, again, I know a lot of people who just went back to their, particularly if they live anywhere out of it all, went back to their hometowns.
We were thinking of that. Me and my partner just moved into a new place in London, so we were like, we've got to stay.
Just moved in. Go, all right, I'll see you in a couple of years.
And bless her, like she, you know, she, it was her first time moving to London. So like when she moved here, it was just, welcome to London. We're going to, you know, look at these four walls all day.
Yeah.
But we spent most of it, and we actually got a dog as well at some point during it. So that kind of helped. And,
perfect.
You know, I can't really, you know, I can't complain about my experience of it. Yeah, it wasn't nice, but, you know, not as bad as in a lot of people's.
Yeah. What point were you at with Phantom of the Open when all this hit? Because I assume you'd finished shooting, or was any of that shot during the...
No, we shot it all during lockdown. So actually...
All during lockdown? I didn't realise that at all.
Yeah, so there was the first wave, and then it eased off a little bit. And I think I was able to go to Wales, and I remember being in Wales, and I got a call from the producer saying that Mark's available for the summer, mm-hmm. and he wants to go then. So... I mean, and when Mark Rylance is available, then it's kind of, it all falls into place. And I get really worried about not having enough time to prep. And this really wasn't enough time to prep. So it was, even though I didn't know if it was definitely going, I kind of just went, you know, full time on trying to prep as much as possible to get it where it should be. So we shot that September, I believe. And it was, yeah, it was pretty new. I think a few productions had shot, but we were in the heart of it. And, if I'm totally honest, it didn't really change much.
Yeah.
The only thing it stopped was more people coming on set and more people being behind Video Village or behind the monitor. And that's not a bad thing, to be honest.
Yeah, exactly. That can give you that greater level of focus, I guess. I mean, we're going to jump a back and forth in this conversation, because I said there's loads of your career I want to talk about. But as you've mentioned, Mark Rylance there, last year, he got all sorts of praise for his performance in Don't Look Up as kind of a career high for him. And it wasn't until I saw Phantom of the Open that I found out that that Don't Look Up wasn't even his best performance of the year, let alone, because I think he's just astounding in this. I think the way he plays this character is so fantastic. And so there's something I really like about your directing style in general, that because it's got a certain character, it would be easy to compare to the Coens and stuff like this, but I think there's more of a realness in there. There's a genuine warmth, and that's not, to be clear, I'm not going to sit here disrespecting the Coens on any podcast. They're arguably the greatest directors of their generation, but with the Coens, it feels like almost a filter of warmth, a stylistic warmth, whereas you seem to manage to get a really unique style. But and Mark Rylance's performance sums it up perfectly. His character is verging on the ridiculous and unrealistic, but it's also so realistic and so grounded at the same time. And I just found that absolutely astounding from him to find that.
I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I mean, yeah, that's all Mark. I mean, at the first conversation I had with him, actually, it was just about, it was about getting him on board, because I'd written a letter to him with the script and he'd responded to that. And then we had a phone conversation, and it was all about grounding the comedy and not making a broad comedy. And I mean, I was totally, you know, we were on the same page. We didn't really, you know, one movie that keeps getting, I think, people keep mentioning with this movie is Eddie the Eagle. Mm-hmm. And I really like Eddie the Eagle. I think it's a great movie. I love Dexter Fletcher, and I think Taron's great in it. But we really didn't want to make that movie. And not because it's bad, because it's great. It was mainly because we didn't want it to be too, I suppose, showy in a way, and too, like, it feels like a studio movie, and that's really great. But I kind of wanted a middle ground of it being accessible, being able to transcend the story from Barrow and make it worldwide, but at the same time, grounding it and making it feel a little bit more gritty. So, like, you know, we made small decisions, like shooting on film on 35 and on 16 and stuff, so that there was a texture to it that felt like this wasn't all like a positive story that's going to end well, even though it kind of does, you know, in a weird way. So with Mark, I talked about, you know, the references I actually talked about were mainly Paul Thomas Anderson. They were Punch Drunk Love, because Punch Drunk Love for me is like, I think, the benchmark for comedy, like in terms of how good it is. It's really real and it's not too much, but yet it's from, you know, it's that tale the pitch is a movie about social anxiety, really. It's about a guy who really doesn't fit in some way.
Yeah.
But he just, the kind of lens he puts on it just makes it feel more accessible and joyous. And that's kind of what we wanted to do. So I mentioned Paul Thomas Anderson to the point where he was like, wow, you really like Paul Thomas Anderson. And I thought I mentioned him too much.
I recently spoke to my agent about trying to get in contact with Paul Thomas Anderson, purely because in several interviews he'd done recently, he spoke highly of a film I was in. And I was only in it a small bit, but I'm such a Paul Thomas Anderson fan. I was like, now is the time for me to say hello to him and say, hey, man, thanks for your kind words. I think you're amazing. But Punch Drunk Love's a great reference, because what I really enjoyed about Phantom of the Open was it has got a grittiness in there. At times it's got a bleakness because of the situation the family are in. But then you almost effortlessly sprinkle in the magic every now and then. And it doesn't feel shoehorned in. It doesn't feel over the top. I think Dexter's a great example of a different approach. Dexter of Fletcher, of when he will bring magic in, but it will be so grand and fantastical. When you kind of bring this magic in, it feels like you're only just veering out of reality, if you know what I mean. Like it's you're still walking on that same street. The fantasy is just, you know, he's in a slightly different place in his head. You know, it's the same street, but it's from a different angle, if you know what I mean, rather than it being we're now up in the stars. It's
yes, exactly. And to be fair to Dexter, I would do the same as him if I had the same budget.
100%.
Like I love that, and I love escapism, and that was what was important with this. And to be, you know, it all goes to Simon really in terms of the magic. It was in the script, and it was just about bringing that to life in some kind of way and making sure it felt right and not too. I mean, Billy Liar was a great reference really for that as well. Billy Liar is such a, I mean, we, to the point where we love that movie so much that we, I think, paid a lot of money to get the clip, wasted a lot of money on that. We probably could have put in something else to get the the clip into the movie before he like goes into the fantasy.
Yeah.
So that was, you know, that was, and to be fair, like again, to Mark, he was just phenomenal. There was, you know, I was surprised every day with what he was doing. And some of the references I mentioned that, you know, I'd sent to him were like the King of Comedy, which was another great reference, because there's a fine line between laughing at and laughing with, and King of Comedy is laughing at, and so it's kind of what not to do, but also at the same time, it's such a phenomenal performance.
Yeah.
You know, there's nothing funnier than somebody that believes they're funny and they're not. Like that's a funny concept. So, you know, it's similar with Morris, really. He believes he can play golf and the powers that be tell him he can't. So that was a reference. And then there was some other ones that I sent him that I can't quite remember. There was one that I sent to him that he was like, this is, I'd sent him a Roy Anderson film, and I actually hadn't sent it to him for the film, but I just sent it to him like a box set of Roy Anderson movies, and the one he picked was just too pornographic. So he watched it, and he was like, I mean, it's not that it's a pornographic movie, but it was just the first one of that box set, which I'd hoped he'd skip, but he actually picked that one to watch and didn't watch the rest of the box set. So that didn't go that.
What are you sending me, man? Why are you? Yeah. Can we?
Why is this a reference? But yeah, every day he was, you know, he totally surprised you on just how wonderful he is and able to adapt and improvise. And he's got that kind of stoic stillness of Benjamin Braddock from The Graduate or Harold and Maude. And I think that's wonderful. So yeah, once we got him on board, it was about just building up the cast around him. And Jean, the wife, was really important to get Sally, really. Nobody else. It was important to get Sally just because she's so good and she could bring so much to the role that, you know, that a lot of people can't, I think.
100%. Well, I'm going to rewind back again a bit, because I think artistically we take so many of our references and our tastes from the stuff that influences us growing up, from the stuff that we watch, from the films that we're into, from the films that inspire us. But I also think that a lifetime of influences as a viewer, you can kind of get an equal impact from one job you work on, from seeing a director, liking things about them, not liking things about how they work, or so on and so forth. And the first film that you came to my attention in was Submarine, and it's really interesting, kind of the reason, because generally anything Paddy Considine's in, I'll be taking a look at. He's
love
an
Paddy.
Absolute
love Paddy
idol of mine, and one of the first podcast guests, and
yeah,
he's given me so much amazing advice over the years. But I didn't know he was in it. The reason I was excited about it, weirdly, was a guy I knew from the spoken word scene, Joe Dunthorne, had written the novel. So I knew Joe, and particularly at that point when we're all doing spoken word, anyone getting something actually picked up and turned into something is like, that's unimaginable, because there's so much stuff that's a bit obscure, that's either self-published or you expect it to be. I've got a book out, but no one's really going to read it, and that kind of thing. And Joe's book got picked up, and all of a sudden it's being directed by Richard Ayoade. And yeah, I adored it. I thought it's fantastic. And Richard has that similar thing there. It's why it came to mind, of having his own really distinctive style that, yeah, you can almost feel, you can feel his influence on it. You know, you have these directors like a Paul Thomas Anderson or the Coens, where you can feel it's one of their films. But then you also get like a Ridley Scott, who I think is one of the greatest of all time. But there's new, like there's he's done so many films that are so different and varied. So yeah, like how was that to work on? And do you feel you kind of took anything in at that point to go, at some point I'm going to be on the other side of the camera, and I like this or I don't like that?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, that opened my eyes for everything, really. I mean, I'd only done those kids' TV shows before then, and I think I've said in the past that they were bad. They weren't bad. It was that I was bad in them. And I just felt like I didn't really know what I was doing, to be honest. And I mean, how can you when you're 14, just saying lines? I mean, it's, you know, I wasn't really, and I, you know, I wasn't approaching it with like, I wasn't getting into character and stuff when I'm 14. I was just saying stuff. So Submarine was the first job that, yeah, that felt like I was fully committing to it in a way that was like, oh my God, I know I have to play a character here. Whereas like in Tracy Beaker, I was just playing myself, really, with a bandana on. The audition process was interesting because I actually didn't turn up to one of the auditions because I had a holiday booked, or like a lad's holiday booked, if that's what they call them. Not that it was a lad's holiday, but in Benidorm. So I actually went to that because
it's in Benidorm. It's a lad's holiday, I'm afraid. Yeah. It is what it is. You have to accept it.
Yeah, so I'd spent the money, so I had to go to that. So I think on the recall, I wasn't available or something, if I'm remembering correctly. And then they started, you know, they did like a nationwide search. They went all over because it was Warp, and they were used to doing the whole, you know, the Shane Meadows of like casting people, street casting and stuff. And then it came back round, and I did an audition with Richard, and it was improvising with Richard. And I think it was I had to convince Richard to go on a date with me. And to be honest, most of the audition was just laughing at what Richard was saying. Yeah. And that really helps, because then, you know, the focus is not on you being bad. Yeah. And then he got me to read like a chapter from the book, and I didn't really know why, but it made more sense once the voiceover went into the movie. So yeah, on the set, I kind of, yeah, it went past in a blur, really, because I didn't really know what I was doing, or I was worried because I was so deadpan in it. And I got these movies from Richard to study, like The Squid and the Whale and like The Graduate or Rushmore, that it felt like an out of body experience. All I knew that, you know, during the experience, he was just so calm. He was so calm. And where I'm at now in my life and what, you know, making films, I just don't know how he was so calm. It was, incredible. And it's because he had his shit together, really. He really knew what he wanted to do. He absolutely knew what he wanted to do.
That's an amazing thing to be exposed to at an early age, right? I think it relaxes everyone. The first ever film set I was lucky enough to be part of was a Guy Ritchie film. And this first scene is like a helicopter shot on a mountaintop with like 300 extras. Yeah. And I was dead nervous. I didn't have any lines. I'm literally in the background on this, but I was dead nervous because I've never been on set before. And then Guy strolls on with a cup of coffee. You're like, you're right. Everyone, he starts with, goes, oh, Pip, and comes over and has a chat. And all this is like, oh, wow, this is such a calming. Again, he's someone because he has his shit together. He preps it and he knows what he wants. And with Guy at that point, he had so much experience. It really helps you kind of go, all right, this doesn't have to be a horrible experience as no, such. I don't have to be beating myself up over this. This can be, oh, let's go and enjoy it. Do your prep and then just go out there and relax and enjoy it rather than that constant tension of, but what if it goes wrong?
Well, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, it is entertainment at the end of the day. It's not open heart surgery.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like there should be a lot of fun behind it. It shouldn't be taken too serious. I mean, I'm all for people taking it seriously and making something really great, but I don't think anybody sets out to make anything bad.
Yeah.
So I don't see why, I find it very strange when people get so stressed to the point where it creates a kind of toxic or bad environment. It's silly. It's absolutely silly. There's no need for it. Just take five, go to the bathroom. Like, or, you know, have drink enough coffee like David Lynch does so that you have loads of bathroom breaks and then you have moments to yourself. That's probably the best advice.
Yeah.
So that you can get away from people.
I heard just before I had a film role that I was getting really worked up about because it meant a lot to me. I listened to, I think it was Andrew Scott on a podcast, and he just said he was doing some theatre at the time, I think. And he said, it's called play for a reason. Because we're meant to be going out there and playing. It's meant to be fun. And it was, I heard that at the perfect time to go, right, actually, I've done my prep. I know I've done my prep. Now just stop looking at it all and go and enjoy the fact you're going to be spending 4 days on set on this huge production with these amazing actors and these amazing things. Drink it in. Don't be there going, right, it's almost my time. So, right, I need to do this. And it was, I heard that at the perfect time when I was really, it was the only time I'd done that. Normally I'm quite...
Yeah.
Let's go and enjoy it. Let's take in the experience. But it's the first one that I was like, I can't mess this up. I can't embarrass myself. And it's like, right, no, just go and have fun.
That pressure's a lot. It's a lot as well to put on yourself. I used to put pressure on myself when I was acting for, it was the line learning, really. I used to be like, you know, drum them in and like, you know, really go over them and over and over. And then there was one, I think I was doing an episode of Casualty and I had practiced my lines loads beforehand, and then when it got to actually doing the take, I actually didn't know what I was saying anymore. I couldn't even understand the words.
It's just noises, yeah.
Yeah, and it completely went, and it was terrible. So after that, I made a point of like, I learned my lines in the morning. Like on my way there, I'd learn them, and then, because by the time we do all the takes, I'll know them for sure.
Yeah, exactly. I've got a, it's such a fine balance on that for me, and I think I've got it now, but I've got a stammer, so if I'm playing a character who hasn't got a stammer, I need to have really drilled my lines and know when I'm going to breathe to make sure I don't stammer as such.
Yeah.
There's this kind of extra almost subconscious work I need to do, but then equally, as you say, I've done that before where I've over drilled it and it's like, right, I'm no longer performing, I'm just going in and roboting my lines. And I had Riz Ahmed on the podcast early on, and he's been a mate for years, and he gave me some really good advice of learn everything inside and out and then be ready to just throw it all away, because either it might change on set or the simple fact that you're performing with someone, you need to have flexibility. If you go in there and you're just rabbiting out your lines with no reaction to what they're giving you, then it's no good. So it's kind of, it's getting that balance, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's whatever works for anyone, really, isn't it? Like, everyone's got different processes. I it's interesting. One reason I like rehearsing so much with as a director is to get rid of stuff, really.
Yeah.
Like, I don't really find rehearsal as, like, beneficial in the way that we're going to use absolutely everything we rehearse. But it's nice to get things out of your system and kind of prepare for what's going to go wrong, really, because things will go wrong. Absolutely. It's always the same on sets. You spend 6 hours shooting the first scene because you're like, oh, it's going to look amazing. And then you get to the end of the day and you've got like 20 minutes to deliver a 3-page monologue. So it's just preparing for that. But so with Richard, I suppose he's been a mentor in some kind of way. He's just an amazing person. He's a library of film, really. He just has he just knows so much.
I've almost had him on the podcast a few times, and I've been really nervous and intimidated because I'm a film nerd, but I know Richard is this next level above of kind of, I feel like I'd need to be in training for a good few weeks before the episode to go, right, come on, now we can have a conversation. I'm ready for you.
Watch, I think Zazie Don LaMetro is like his favourite film. That's his go-to. So if you've seen that, then I think you're sorted.
Okay, I like it.
Yeah, so after that, to be honest, before that, I didn't really have an idea of, like, I didn't have an idea of, you know, a couple of years before that of being an actor. So I certainly didn't have the idea in my head to be a director. But seeing him, and then it was seeing Paddy as well do Tyrannosaur, because he did that straight after. We didn't know he was doing Tyrannosaur.
Right, wow, the timing of that, that's amazing then.
Yeah, he went straight on to Tyrannosaur and then shot that afterwards, and they both came out at the same time.
Imagine having both of those things in his head, his character in Submarine and Tyrannosaur, both living side by side. They're not common bedfellows, but...
Not at all. And then to find out that it took him, a week to write Tyrannosaur, it just blows my mind. Crazy. Yeah. So, it was both of those, really. I mean, certainly Richard, because I'd spent more time with him. And he during the press of Submarine is when he told me to watch a movie called Punch Drunk Love, and that changed my life. Mm. That made me see how, you know, cinema, for me, how it should be, and what I wanted to make. So that plan, he definitely planted the seed of... this is not just acting, you can do a lot more. So after that, I started writing, and now I'm here. Now it's the end.
I love it. I love it. And I love that continued seed, that passing on of Richard handing Punch Drunk Love onto you, and then on this latest production, you kind of going, here's one of the main references. This is...
Yeah, it was for my last one as well, Eternal Beauty. That was Punch Drunk Love was for that as well. Yeah. And to be honest, it's going to be a reference for every film I do, I think, just because the grammar of it, the way it's shot, like it's just so well made. I work with a director called Hal Hartley, who you know made some great films, but he directed a TV show that I did called Red Oaks that I was acting in, and this was a comedy set in the 80s in America, kind of Caddyshacky vibes, I suppose. But he told me that before every project he watches Full Metal Jacket. And I was like, why? He's like, just the grammar of it, just the way it's put together and just how he shoots it. And I think that Punch Drunk Love has become that for me. It's my safe space. When I'm about to go into something, I just watch that. And I know that that's a 90-minute film. There's no massive set pieces. It's two people for the majority of the ride. Yeah. And it looks fantastic. And I think that's just become a kind of mantra.
And I love it when there's these performances and actors who people forget how good they are. Like when Adam Sandler got all this praise for Uncut Gems and everyone was shocked. It's like, no, he's always been amazing. Ben Affleck's another one that kind of people will forget how good he is. And then he'll do something and win loads of awards and go, how mad? And it's like, no, he's always been that good. He just does a variation of stuff. He's got things that are his favourites. But if he wants to be dropped into this absolute masterpiece, of course he's got the chops to...
Exactly. Uncut Gems felt like a good double bill with Punch Drunk Love. It really did. I feel the same about Brad Pitt. I think Brad Pitt's the best. I love Brad Pitt.
Yeah.
And when Once Upon a Time in Hollywood came out, I watched that movie over and over and over again because he's just phenomenal in it. He's really funny.
That's an amazing film for people in the industry as well, because I think...
Yeah.
DiCaprio's performance in that, from getting you comfortable with him playing a not very good actor to then when his actor gives an amazing performance and you've almost forgotten that DiCaprio's this amazing award-winning actor.
Yeah.
When he turns on that performance, it's jaw-dropping because you're like, oh shit, this is... Yeah, he does so good at kind of subtly doing bad acting as such. Like, it's not comical, it's not over the top, it's just not very... Yeah. There's just not a lot of effort in it. And then when he turns on that effort in the scene with the little girl, you're just like, wow, this is what's
reminded. Exactly. Yeah. He should, I think DiCaprio should have got it. Not that, you know, I mean, not that the right people get them anyway in terms of awards, but he should have got them.
Yeah.
He should. I feel like that performance was just incredible. It reminded me of Ralph Fiennes in Budapest Hotel. Like it was that solid, that solid.
That was also a great year for showing humans what is possible with a 50-year-old Brad Pitt looking that good in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood and Jennifer Lopez in Hustlers the same year, 50 years old, just looking astounding. And it's like a little
Hustle was fantastic. I loved Hustle.
Yeah,
I thought it was a great movie.
Yeah,
really great movie.
It was fantastic. Yeah, really good. Well, I mean, let's get back to a Phantom of the Open because as I said, I really loved it. I didn't catch it when it initially had a bit of a cinema release. I was aware of it because of, and it's weird because I had a podcast yesterday where I was speaking about this a lot, but I'm a big fan of Shaheen Baig. I think she's a fantastic casting director, and generally there's her, Carmel Cochrane, Des Hamilton, there's a few others who I really keep an eye on what they're doing because their projects are normally good. It's weird to get to a point of being such a film nerd that I've got favourite casting directors as well as favourite writers and producers and directors, but I'd seen her posting about it and raving about it, so I was delighted to finally see it. How much of the process is casting? You spoke about getting Mark, and yeah, you spoke about your preference, who you wanted, who you needed these to be. Sally, obviously, I thought the twins were just electric. The Lees twins were amazing. How important a part of the process is that for you at the start of a project, I guess?
It's absolutely everything, because if you have bad actors, I can get my pretentious 35mm film and I can get my 16mm and I can make it look all pretty and looking cool, and it means nothing unless you've got good actors.
Yeah.
Like, if you've got great actors and an iPhone, you're still going to have a better film than you do with, you know, all the equipment and bad actors.
Yeah.
So it's absolutely everything. And Shaheen's amazing. She's fantastic. She'd really helped me out with my first film that was really made for nothing at all. And beyond her being great at what she does, I just really like her. She's just fantastic. She's really funny and she's just a lovely person.
Completely
she's such
agree.
A lovely person.
We've never worked together, but I've known her for years now because she was the first person before I had an agent or anything, I hustled a meeting with. And it's just always a joy to be in there, to be, working with and involved with.
She's just got so much time for people, which is great. So, and you know, like it's really interesting who working with HODs that you've worked with before, because, you know, it's good to work with new people and, you know, open up that gate in some kind of way. But at the same time, it's also, there's a level of, you've already progressed through stages once you've already worked with somebody. So it's much easier, I suppose. Yeah. So yeah, on this, I definitely wanted to work with Shaheen, and I was worried about the twins, certainly, because I was just worried we weren't going to find them, really. Mm. And it really got down to the line. I think we'd started prep potentially when we'd cast them, which I know is normal, but my anxiety was through the roof. I was like, no, we need these pretty quickly. And then Jake Davies, who plays Mike, that was a audition process of just seeing a load of tapes. And he just stood out to me as like, what I really loved about him was, I suppose a lot of people were, and rightfully so, interpreting it as like a comedy, and they were playing that in the scenes. And he didn't really, he kind of just grounded it and he just seemed really pissed off, which I really liked, to be honest. I really liked about it. So yeah, I knew he was right. And then Sally was, that was a few conversations with Sally being like, you know, you're incredible. And I just feel like you and Mark together is like a winning duo. So that was fine. But yeah, it's absolutely everything, just because certainly when you're making a movie about family and about love and about supporting one another, there needs to be a real chemistry. And one of the first scenes we shot was, there's a scene after like the flashbacks of like how we got to where we are. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it says like the Phantom of the Open. And then it's like a crazy scene in the house where they're all talking over each other.
Yeah.
That was the first scene we shot. And my intention was like, weirdly, Uncut Gems was, everyone talk over each other, go crazy, and we'll try and pick up whatever we can pick up. And I think it was very freeing for everybody doing it, because it wasn't like, okay, here's your first close-up and we're going to really do this now. We want to hear your lines and everyone's going to be very quiet for it. It was kind of, I can be the character, I can shout, I can do whatever I want. So I think that was a really nice, although we'd rehearsed before that, that felt like, okay, now we're going. Now the ball's rolling a bit.
It works and it stands out as a scene, because that was the one that instantly, the twins in that instantly, I was like, oh, these guys are great, because it felt so natural. And it is because of that, as you say, Uncut Gems style of everyone's just talking over each other, because it's a family and they're at home in their living room on their own. They're not going to be taking it in turns to say their lines and have their moment. They're going to be dancing around. They're going to be annoying each other. They're going to be throwing things at each other, because that's a family, a working class family in a small living room with a new TV at this point and all this kind of thing. There's going to be all of that going on. It's
exactly.
It needs to be manic.
Yeah, it's very, you know, when I'm at my house with my family, it's very rare we all wait for people to speak.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? We don't go, hey, Dad, how are you? I'm fine, thank you. How are you? It's like kind of just like we all talk over each other, and it's there's a lack of discipline, I suppose.
It was the thing, genuinely, it was the thing that annoyed people the most when I first started this podcast like 8 years ago, because I was like, it's conversation, so we're going to interrupt each other. It's not a TV interview where we go, so what was it like making Phantom of the Opera? And then you talk, and then it's like, no, there's going to be back and forth, there's going to be interruptions, and because it's real conversations. And yeah, it, I love that. It makes it the reality.
It's
of
more
it.
Accessible. It's just more accessible. And it's just yeah. I think it's a great way to look at it.
It's one of the things I mentioned Ridley Scott earlier, and he's on my list of people to work with, obviously because he's Ridley Scott,
yeah.
But also because the people I know who've worked with him all talk of him having always between a 4 and 8 camera setup. So yeah. Every scene is always just free flowing. You've got it all there. It's not, we're going to do this again on your close up, or we're going to turn this round on you. Each time you do a take, it's captured. And the freedom and excitement of that seems amazing. You know, rather than thinking, oh, if this is our sixth take, I can't really change much now because we've got it all in the beats on the close up. So I can't now be over here. The idea of that as an actor just sounds like a playground to go in and enjoy.
For sure, yeah. He also, I think he storyboards absolutely everything.
Yeah.
And he draws them himself. Like, it's, I think...
James Gunn's one that blows me away for that. You see pictures of his storyboards and it's like, why did you bother shooting it? Like, just show me this. You've made the film here. This is amazing.
Mine are like stick men. It's
yeah. Completely understand. So, I mean, how did the story and the script come to you? Because every time I see, and for people, I mean, I realise that we've not mentioned what the film is at all. Essentially, it's a true story of a guy who worked in a factory, essentially at retirement age, and decided to give golf a try, and almost accidentally enters the British Open.
Yeah.
And every time... regularly there'll be an amazing true story like this, then I'll be like, right, that's got to be the last one now. Like, there can't be any more of these insane characterful true stories left out there. We've made so many of them, and then as I said, one like this comes along that I hadn't heard about at all, and again, all the while you're watching, as wonderful as Mark Rylance is, as wonderful as the story is, there's a part of you that's like, I can't wait for the bit at the end where we get to see the real person. As always, it has to happen. It's a rite of passage on these things. You have to end with, here's some footage of the real person. And it's astounding. Like, it must have been exciting to find to have this come along and go, oh wow, how hasn't this been made?
Yeah, it really was. And also, to be fair, the real footage at the end, you know, it's kind of like, it's like a cheat code. Because you know it's going to get people, or you know it's going to, people will be like, ah, that's great. So you kind of spend the whole movie working your way up to that to try and earn that, if I'm totally honest.
Yeah.
So the way it came about was through the producers, really, Nick Martin and Tom Miller. They came to see my movie Eternal Beauty at London Film Festival, and then we had a conversation about it, and I loved the script, and I thought it was fantastic. But the references I was talking about was like Boogie Nights and... I think I mentioned Goodfellas at one point, and then somebody killed that. I think the BFI killed that. But I was just, I was just talking about how I don't essentially, and look, I love Ken Loach movies and I love the realness of them. They make me cry and I need to like really take a second after watching all of them. But I didn't really want to make a socially real film, although there are moments in this film that are bleak and are, there are, I suppose, shades of social realism in it. This was a movie about somebody defying and going against their birth lottery. And I didn't want it to be grey and desaturated and just really bleak. I wanted it to be through his lens, really, to show his optimism and show what he thinks he could achieve. So that's why I was mentioning those kind of movies. I mean, I'm not sure Catch Me If You Can was a reference as well, mainly for like, the kinetic energy and the rhythm of it all. So yeah, I met them, and then I met Simon, and us talking about the script and going through bits of it, and then the next stage was with Mark, and then we went through the script with Mark and stuff. But I didn't know about the story at all, and neither did my dad. And my dad was a really good golf player. He didn't know about it. And to be fair, like one of the reasons for making this was the other two films I've made were slightly abstract, I suppose, in some way, and I knew that my dad would definitely enjoy this one. Mm. So it was like, it felt cool to make this for my dad in some way, I suppose.
Here's one that he'll genuinely enjoy rather than tell me I've done very well.
Yeah, exactly. Although, I knew that he'd be like, no, that's not how to do that, and not how to do that when it came to the golf.
Yeah.
That was a big challenge, certainly. Like, it's not like it's Raging Bull where you're beating people up, and that's entertaining in itself.
Yeah.
For some people, I suppose. But this was golf, and as much as there are a lot of people that love it, a lot of people don't like it at all. So we needed to really, most of the prep was how we keep this interesting and how we shoot it in a way that like doesn't just feel like, you know, Mark stood on a big green can get very boring very quickly, mm-hmm. unless you do something with it. And that, again, going back to like Boogie Nights, and I just suppose as early Scorsese, early PTA of moving the camera a lot.
Yep.
So I didn't know about the story, but I didn't think I'd ever make a sports film ever, really. But what got me into the script was one scene, and I'm going to go back to Punch Drunk Love with this. There's a scene in the script that says Morris walks out of the shipyard and opens his overalls, and you see like Superman almost.
Yeah.
And as soon as I read that, I was like, okay, now I know my way in. Like, I know, because you got to, I feel like this is the first time ever, you know, directing someone else's script. And certainly I was worried about if I didn't have a way to tell it, or like my way into it, so I could try and make it my own in some way.
Yeah.
And that was it, weirdly, the Superman thing, because with Eternal Beauty, we were massively influenced by what he did with Punch Drunk Love. Because in Punch Drunk Love, Barry Egan, his character, is actually Superman.
Yeah.
So, and Mark Kermode's talked about this, and there's like videos that break it down that he's actually Superman. He's a superhero and he doesn't know how to deal with his powers. And that's why he's socially anxious. So weirdly, I was like, oh, this kind of fits into like after what we did with Eternal Beauty of being Superman in some way. So we kept that bit, and there were like loads of Easter eggs, like throughout, like his number plate says something. And like we created the golf vest, so that it's essentially all the Superman colors in a diamond.
Yeah.
So we took all these little things. And again, it was just about finding my own way into it. And like, nobody's ever going to know anything about this. Well, they will now if they listen, but you know, nobody's ever going to read into it that much. Even like the dog, it's the same dog that Superman had and stuff like that.
Oh, wow. I love those little references.
Yeah. Silly. And we actually, you know, we definitely ripped Superman for like going around the globe. And it turning into a ball. So, yeah, there was that. There was also another theme that I had in terms of iconography of Guy Fawkes. Mm-hmm. We had a Guy Fawkes thing throughout because I just felt like this guy going in and taking down the establishment felt really right.
Yeah.
But that was in the movie that was 3 hours long and not a comedy at all. But nobody would ever see that cut.
Well, just because of hearing the early reference being shot down, can I ask that you hit Mark Rylance up and just do a Goodfellas edit of the trailer with Morris at the start saying, as far back as I can remember, I always wanted to be a golfer. just do a dark edit of the trailer to show a variation of what the film could be. We'll wrap things up in a minute as we're almost at the hour mark. But how is it when you're approaching a film that's about real life people? How much do you want to lean towards authenticity or accuracy? And how much do you focus on, no, what's right for the story, what's right for the tone, and what's right for the film that you're making? Because again, I always argue on these things when directors make choices that go off kind of course slightly, is it's not a documentary. It's a dramatization. Mm-hmm. It's a film. Mm-hmm. So where's the balance on that for you? And are you working with the directors on the actors on that, or are you letting them make their choices on how much it wants to be an accurate portrayal and how much it needs to be the character that they've found?
That's a great question. I wasn't worried about accuracy.
Yeah.
Mainly because I didn't want to make a biopic.
Yeah.
I didn't want it to be The Darkest Hour. And The Darkest Hour is fine. No shade on that. But we didn't want to like completely change Mark's face to make him look like Morris and stuff. And it just takes you out. For me, it takes me out of it. It just feels like, and also you're never really going to get to that. You're never really going to get to complete accuracy. So why would you even attempt to? Mm. Like, you're not going to, it's not the person. So it just felt like, yeah, I definitely didn't want to do that. I talked with Mark a little bit about it. But for us, it was mainly about capturing his spirit and his soul, really, and just how optimistic he was. It was just about taking that. Of course, with the accent, you know, you want to get some, you know, close to it. And Mark did a really great job. And Mark spent a good bit of time with the family, with Morris's family that are still around. And that was great for him. But I didn't really want to jump into the pool of, this is a complete, yes, it's a true story, but if we start like putting wigs on and stuff like that, then it could get really, really messy. So it was about him. Yeah. Mark kind of looks like him anyway, in some way. and he's of a similar ilk, I suppose. So that was fine. And we made certain decisions, but it was never about going the full, let's have a costume party.
Yeah. And on the kind of after it's made front, I guess, how do you approach letting people know what you kind of had to learn before you took it on, that it's not a golf movie? And there's a weird comparison here, but I watch a streamer on Twitch called David Earl, who's an actor and comedian. He did Brian Gittins. He's an amazing guy. And he plays a lot of sports games on there that I have no interest in at all, but I'm thoroughly enthralled with because of the stories he makes up alongside of with it, the way he is going through it. And like, he does a lot of American football at the moment, but he's previously done all sorts of different sports I'm not interested in. But because he's a writer and a comedian, he'll make up all these storylines like for different players in the team, all this backstage stuff. And it's so enthralling. If you told me I'd be watching hours of someone playing American football, I would have said, nah, that's never going to happen. But I can't get enough of it. And it's similar here. I think I probably would have or should have seen Phantom of the Open a little earlier than I did. But because I'm not a golf fan, I was like, I'm not really into golf. It's not really my thing. But it's not a golf movie. It's a movie with golf in it.
It's the backdrop, really. The backdrop. It's a movie about hope. I mean, look, for obvious reasons, it's been tough times. And I feel like I definitely feel that at its core, yes, cinema should hold the mirror up to society. And I think that's important. But at the same time, I want escapism with my movies. I want to be able to completely escape. And that's what this offers. It's just everybody loves an underdog story for reasons I don't, like I love 8 Mile. I absolutely love 8 Mile. Like, and that's what this is 8 Mile, golf 8 Mile. what was my point? I think that it's a movie about supporting people and lifting people up to be who they want to be or become what they want. So yes, it's golf, but it could be anything for you. Like, it could be anything that you want to pursue. And we keep it entertaining enough because we have a good soundtrack. So if anybody's worried about the golf, come for the tunes. And then stay for Mark and the great actors.
And again, I think you really, the way you navigate the story and slowly introduce us to different kind of elements of the family is done beautifully. And it really all culminates with one of the scenes towards the end, which had me in tears. It's so subtle and beautiful, the way you let us in to the family life is really quite subtle. So by the end, I didn't realize how much I cared about this family and cared about them knowing who cares and who loves who and what they all mean to each other. Because again, that's so typically and relatable family life that you rarely think to mention how much you love this person or how much this person means to you or the influence they've had. You assume it's an unspoken thing.
Yeah.
But then that means that when it is spoken, it's fucking heartbreaking. And again, I felt I was drawn into that. And I thoroughly enjoyed it.
I know that scene you're referencing, it's like, that was certainly the biggest moment in the film for me when I read the script, because it's about her and it should be about her. Yeah. How many bloody men have succeeded by, their wives propping them up.
Yeah.
And, he was very, I think that Morris was absolute determined hero to do what he did. And it's, you can't do that also without having the support of your family. Yeah. And certainly within the case of this script and, with what this story is saying, that was important to me to have. It could seem like a love story with golf, but it's not a love story with golf. It's for me, it's a love story between them both and what they do for each other.
How was it when you saw Mark's performance of that? Because again, it isn't delivered like the big moment in a film, the big actor's moment in a film. It's delivered like a stumbling, awkward old man, and that just makes it hit home all the more. It's not this big, here's the big beat and the big reveal and the big declaration. It's kind of mumbled and stumbled along, and that is perfect.
It's the wonders of Emery. Like, that's why he's so wonderful. He's, it's underplayed in the most beautiful way.
100%. So many actors would have read that part in the script, as you said, and gone, well, this is the big moment.
Big
moment. He kind of, it's not. It's that, and that's what makes it the big moment as such.
Yeah, and it was an interesting time in the edit because I always knew that scene would be more emotional when you put music in it, like anything. Yeah. And, you know, we played around a lot with that. We played around. To be honest, the first cut of the movie that I had, I held it all on a very close-up of him, almost like there was nobody in the room. Like, it was all in his head.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, this is not a comedy. It was more so, it felt like a Charlie Kaufman film. Yeah. It was just all in his head that this was happening. The whole movie was a great, great experience because it was just an experiment as well at the same time. You know, we had so much footage, you know, and it was a long edit. John Amos, the editor, was fantastic. And it was just about piecing it together like it always is. You know, you think that what's on the page is what's going to come out, and it never really is, as you know. So that was really interesting. But that scene was, you know, we knew again we had to earn to get to that. We had to earn the respect of the audience and have to get people on board. And that's nice that you said that, you know, it kind of by the end you realize, because it does kind of wash over you, you know. Yeah. they're not in your face. They're kind of just, they're living their lives, and it's a day in the lives of them, I suppose, in a way.
Yeah.
And that's what Once Upon a Time in Hollywood did so well. You know, it kind of washes over you.
Yeah.
It's like you, by the end of it, you want to spend more time with these people. And that was the aim, really. What is Twitch? Is Twitch the where you watch? So you watch, because I watch people on YouTube playing FIFA all the time. I waste so much time just watching people play FIFA when I could be playing it myself.
So that's probably a lot of people do it on Twitch live, and then they upload it to YouTube of their recording of it. So Twitch is where most people will play computer games, and you're there and you can comment and interact. But yeah.
Okay.
It's good fun. But I mean, it feels as if we could talk for absolutely hours on end, but I am going to wrap things up now. So what is ahead, I guess? Like, this has obviously been a huge project from the starting point to, as I said, from the sounds of it, a huge edit. What's ahead? What's next? Have you had any time to settle into your new London home? Because again, a pandemic and a film is really two things that take you out of the normal situation, right?
Yeah, you're right. I've got a PlayStation 5. That's what's next. So
perfect.
Playing there.
Your parents will be furious. They've been trying so hard to get you off computer games. It's just not working.
Take the boy out of Wales.
Yeah.
I've been writing a script for the last like 4 years in terms of work. I'm going to shoot that this summer, and it's called Honey. And yeah, I suppose it's a Greek tragedy in some way about a relationship.
Great. That sounds fantastic.
So that's going to be the next year or so, I think, of my life, probably.
I love it. Brad, I look forward to all that's ahead, and I'm glad we got to sit down and have this chat. I've really enjoyed it.
I love the podcast, so thank you for having me on, man. I really appreciate it. Great to chat.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Distraction Pieces.
There we go. That was Craig Roberts. I honestly can't recommend Phantom of the Open strongly enough. It blew me. I loved it. I loved every moment of it, as you will have heard from the rambling and the details I was going into and the moments I was clearly excited about. So, yeah, check that out. I'll be back next week with more wonderful chat. As ever, I'm setting up a podcast studio over on Twitch on Rust. So I'm going to have some people. It's weird. It's a different world. Don't ask too many questions. But yeah, if you want to head to twitch.tv/ScroobiusPipio, you can find me there. I'll be on the socials and everything as ever. But until next week, stay safe and stay sane. Ta-ta.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.